I used to be glad it was a...
We're going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and we'll open up an informational hearing about the foster care system in Oregon. And we're going to hear first from the Department of Human Services. We have several people out today, and a couple of people are coming in late. And I know that your little program is turned upside down or something, or sideways, so is that true? Oh, no, you're okay. Great. Perfect. And this is just an overview. We have bills regarding foster care coming into our committee. So the first couple of months of legislative session, we hear those bills and we hear from the agency and from other people interested in foster care. What we're wanting now is to educate ourselves about foster care. Some of us have been former foster parents. Some of us are still foster parents. Some of us have been foster children. So we just want an overview of foster care in Oregon at this point. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for having us. My name is Marita Johnson, and I'm the Deputy Child Welfare Director. And with me is Kevin George, who's the manager for our well-being program, which includes foster care.
Great.
And we'd like to give you that overview today. Want to talk a little bit about our child welfare program mission and goals as it relates to foster care, our foster care program. And we really decided that we wanted to frame it as the child's experience in foster care.
Great.
And we wanted to look at where we were at 10 years ago and then bring you all up to date today about some of our strengths and things that we've overcome, and then some of our ongoing struggles about meeting the needs of children who experience foster care. So, our mission and goals, of course, are to, as it relates to foster care, is to improve family capacity and provide a safe and permanent living environment for children who come into care. Our goals are to protect and promote child safety. We want to make sure kids are safe, both in their home as well as when they're in substitute care. Help children who are unable to live safely in their homes, live in a setting that provides the safety they need, as well as the stability and the continuity with their families and their culture. We'd like to ensure that we expand our program partnerships and not work in isolation. We want to ensure that we are meeting the needs of our children while engaging our local communities to meet their needs. And also to be able to provide for the cultural considerations for children in foster care. We'd like to prevent the future need of children to be placed in foster care or to go into any kind of higher level services. And most importantly, we'd also like to mitigate trauma, because we want to ensure that our kids are have the least amount of trauma when they experience their foster care situation. So I want to take a look back in 2002 and what where we were at in foster care, particularly first around safety. Back in 2002, we had a federal review, and so I pulled some of the themes from that review. Our reabuse rate was higher than the national average. Our attention to safety in foster care was just really evolving. We were just beginning to do criminal history checks on all foster parents. Our foster parents had a visit only once a year from a certifier. So the person that that came in and did an assessment of their home and did their home study, they were only required to visit that family once a year. And our foster parent training was really pretty sporadic. It wasn't very uniform. And it was not very consistently implemented. If you look back at permanency in foster care and how a child experienced permanency, children in foster care back then remained in care longer, and our state, once again, didn't meet the national standards for reunification. Stability of foster care placements was below the national standard. Despite our emerging work around placing kids with relatives, and we had a neighborhood foster care project back then. And case planning back then was seen as to be very sequential and not concurrent. So that meant that when we removed a child and placed that child in foster care, the worker would focus on a return home plan for an extended period of time. And then when that return home plan didn't look like it was going to work, then they would start working on the adoption plan. And so children really stayed in care a lot longer than we could have left them in care. And looking back at well-being in foster care, once again, relative placement was an emerging practice. And so generally the practice was more focused on ruling relatives out rather than ruling them in. And so as a worker would do an assessment, they were more likely to not look at the strengths of the provider and how they could provide for the needs of the child. There was not enough foster homes that could meet the needs of children. We were sorely lacking in foster homes, and so we had difficulty meeting the needs of our children. Our circle of support was much smaller then. We didn't really look to our communities to be able to help us keep kids safe and then provide for their safety and well-being needs while they're in foster care. Increased face-to-face contact between workers and foster parents was just beginning to increase because right around this time we had a policy change that that really focused on increasing the quality of our face-to-face contact with foster parents and foster children. Siblings were less likely to be placed together, so oftentimes we had siblings separated in different foster homes and they were unable to be together and move forward through foster care. Obtaining health and education services was really determined by how hard the foster parent advocated for a child. It wasn't very systematically put in place. If a child had a health screening, which we were doing at the time really well with health screenings, follow-up services weren't necessarily always engaged in. And if those follow-up services actually happened, it was due to the advocacy of the foster parent and the caseworker. And the mental health needs of children were not always universally met either, especially those for teens.
All right, now I'll take...
Madam Chair, do you want questions?
Sure.
Could you go back to that last slide, please?
Uh-huh.
Do you have percentages on relative placement for your foster?
Back then?
This is still 2002, so you're... you going to show me how we've improved that?
I could look it up. I don't have it off the top of my head, but if...
That's a big priority for me, and that's and for you too, I'm assuming, so I'd be interested later in that data if you can provide the committee that.
We have one slide that talks about 4 years.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, again, my name is Kevin George, and I am the Child Wellbeing Program Manager and Representative Wisnett. We do have a short slide here in just a minute about relatives for a four-year window, not an eight-year.
Thank you.
And so I know we have a lot of folks who are going to testify today, so I'm going to go over some of this data a little bit quick because you already have it in your hands. But really the continuum here, this funnel that many of you have seen before is really the child welfare system that it starts out with the nearly 75,000 calls and then where it evolves down into 4,398 kids or children were removed into foster care. And then we actually have 431 young people actually moving from foster care to adulthood. And that's a unique population that we'll talk about a little bit more here as we go. In general, here's the race breakdown and the age breakdown.
Kevin, let me ask you a question before you move on.
Yes.
Well, we have testimony from some of those folks who were in foster care and have moved on to adulthood.
It's my understanding today you'll be hearing some of that from folks.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
I have a question on the last slide, too. There are 74,342 reports of child abuse or neglect, and less than half of those resulted in assessments. So what happened to the other half of them? How would you identify what happened?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, those are calls that we receive that get screened out. or don't meet our criteria to go out and complete a CPS assessment.
Can you give us an example of that kind of call?
Sure.
Chair Tremaine, Representative Wisnett, part of what the example I would give anyway is that sometimes we have calls where you have maybe a couple who are fighting over custody of a child, and so mom's calling in the child abuse hotline because dad didn't bring their child back from a visit on time. Well, that's going to be a call that comes into our line. That's not necessarily really a report of child abuse, but we're still taking those calls. We still have to at least respond to them. Other times you might get that folks are calling in about a neighbor and that they're complaining about how the kids are running the streets late at night, or that the kids looked unkempt. And so it might be those kind of calls that first come in, and then we have to respond by maybe calling other collateral contacts to say, give us more information on this. And so we start those kind of things, but they don't turn into an actual assessment, meaning someone's going to actually get up out of the office and actually go out and look at all these. All right. So, as I said, then the number, what's a little bit unique in Oregon, in comparison to other states, is the age groups. We really break down the age groups. About one-third of the kids are under age 5. About a third of them are between 6 and 12, and the other third are over 13. And this is not similar to a lot of other states. A lot of other states will either have a big group of real little kids or a big group of teenagers, and ours has been pretty much a third, and a third for a good portion of at least my time at the department. And then it's also evenly split between the girls and boys, about 50-50 in care. Here's one of the slides that some of you may have seen in another presentation. In terms of, we've seen a decrease of 14% of children coming into foster care that have spent at least one day in care. Again, we use the one-day care marker because there are children who might come in today. We might determine that there's an aunt, or there's another family member, or there's a dad, or there's a mom that can actually take the child, so they'll go back home the next day. The average number of children in foster care has decreased over the last 4 years by 7%, and the children entering care is a decrease of 3%. Representative Wisnett asked the question about relative placement, so the percentage of children. So we've reduced the number of kids coming into care, and we've increased the number of kids being placed with relatives by 8% over the last 4 years, from 2007 to 2011. We're also serving more children in their homes instead of removing them. And then we also have an increase of children being safer and not being re-abused as well.
So we have these percentages. Can you give us some numbers that go with these percentages?
You know, I don't have those with me, but we can certainly turn around and ask
that would be
for those to be submitted
Thank
to you.
Thank you.
This is a slide that really talks holistically more about the child welfare system and that it's so interdependent. And this is what Marita alluded to earlier, is that 10 years ago, there would have been probably about 3 or 4 circles around this. But the reality is that caring for children really is the whole notion of it takes a village concept, that all of these programs and services are critical to caring for kids in the state's care. And most importantly, things like housing is something that's really been added on over the last several years, of how important that is, that if we can just take care of housing issues, that some of our children can actually stay with their families, that if it's that those kind of issues. The health care and behavioral health, those are very critical issues for children. So we work closely with the Oregon Health Authority to make sure what programs they're designing and models that they're creating are really going to be conducive to serving our kids the best as possible. And then really the faith and business communities are areas that we've not really reached out to in the past, and we're doing more of that kind of work now in order to be able to care for kids. And I think there are some examples that you might hear about more today, as well as other examples in many communities around the state where people are coming forward and helping out, whether they're the local car dealer, whether they're the local attorney, whether they're the local school teacher, or whether they're just somebody who cares for children in the community and helping out. Some of the things that we've really focused on as far as the foster care, so we're really focusing on the experience of children and experience of others in the foster care system over the last several years. One has been through our Safe Home Study, and this is a model of which has some evidence-informed practice behind it, and it's a way of actually assessing. It really stands for Structured Analysis Family Evaluation. So it's a way of, instead of just meeting with a prospective foster family and finding out who they are and what their history is, it's taking information and doing a more thorough analysis on that and then making better decisions so that we actually are looking at placement matching for children and having quality foster parents in our system. The foster care safety team, which was a group of folks that met together here a couple of years ago, had a number of program improvements in place. One was that we should move our foster home certifiers to meeting the families at least every 180 days physically in the homes, the foster homes. And then we have sensor review committees that are in every district, which actually is a combination of foster home certifiers, caseworkers, supervisors, branch managers, and some committees actually even have community staff on them or community representation to really assess families. And so it's an earlier warning sign, so we don't have to wait till something happens before then we're looking at, is this the right foster home? But it's a caseworker who might be able to say, you know, I'm not feeling good about this foster home, something doesn't feel right, and be able to go in and actually staff it more of an early warning system in looking at that kind of work.
How are you finding foster homes? How do people identify themselves as being willing to be foster parents?
Yeah, Representative Tomei, there are a number of ways. So we have the standard canned 800 line that people call in. They'll see an ad, they'll see a picture, they'll see some notification, and they'll think about it. Research tells us, we know that from a marketing standpoint, that people really need to see the information about 7 times before they're going to actually act upon it. So just having things out there in the community, whether it's a bookmark in a library, whether it's something in the newspaper, just keeps people thinking about it. Really, it really comes from the same part of volunteerism. And how do people volunteer? They don't do it the first time. It's after they thought about it for a while and figure out, is this going to work for me? So we use those kind of strategies. Quite frankly, word of mouth is a great way of doing it. So focusing in on the foster parents that we do have, providing the great support and retention to them, they then tell their friends and tell their friends and tell their friends, and that's really how a lot of folks come in. Where we've been, a lot of our focus over the last year, or last couple years, really has been on the relatives. And so trying to identify when a child comes into care, who knows this child? Is there family members available? If not family, is there a neighbor? Is there a school teacher? Is there somebody from their church that knows this child already? And we've changed our rules and policies so we can actually go out and certify somebody in a pretty short period of time to make sure that the child can actually go with them today. So if a child can actually go with grandma, auntie, and uncle, great. If they can't do that, if they can go with somebody they already know, that's much better than going into a stranger care right off the bat. So we try multiple ways of doing that work. The training is another area that we have always struggled on, and this really is those things where it gets down into budget issues around you never have enough money to do anything, so where do you start cutting things? And training is one of those areas that always gets cut in all kinds of services. And so we've tried to be very clear about knowing that we need to be able to take in a very finite amount of money to be able to provide training and be as resourceful as possible so that we are using community collaborations, we are using early intervention programs, other people who are teaching parenting skills. And then look at it saying that within adult learning theory, not everybody's going to learn best by having a classroom setting. So if we have multiple ways that people can be educated, whether it's online, whether it's books, we've started a statewide lending library so people can get books and videos from that, foster parents can, it's like the Netflix model. It's really a good way to be able to have somebody that can actually learn the information the best way that they're going to. We're also always looking at how else do we work with this. So one of the programs we're working with right now is out of Eugene area, Northwest Media, where they have a grant and they're working in another state on developing foster parent curriculum. So we're going to be a test site for them to actually do some of the evidence-based practice to say, can we do an online model of this type of curriculum that we could actually do in Oregon? So as a way of being more efficient and be more flexible within our family. So we're looking at ways in the future that we can actually structure these programs so it's not the same way that it looked 10 years ago when I would have been teaching those classes. So again, more on the relatives piece. This is a critical part of our system. Again, we moved from 19 to 27% of children being placed with relatives. It really is important that if relatives can't take children in, they can still be a part of that system, meaning that they can still provide, they can still go visit children, they can still provide cards and letters and birthdays and a variety of those kind of things. Family finding is another kind of a strategy on which sometimes our families that we're working with may not want to tell us where grandma or grandpa lives or who they are for a variety of reasons, whether it's family shame or whatever the reasons are. So we have family finding processes around the state in many locales, and it's one of those great models that it doesn't take a DHS person to do that. It's one of those things that can use volunteers, and so we use volunteers in many communities to help us do that kind of work. And it really is checking databases and websites and a variety of ways that people can find other people now and try to engage those families in caring for these children or at least supporting them. This is one of the statistics that I'm most proud of in Oregon as far as foster care, the siblings. We actually had a state in Georgia, program in Georgia, who came out to Oregon to tell us about a model of sibling placements. When I asked them their statistics, they were proud to share that they were placing about 60% of their kids with siblings. And then I showed them our numbers, and we're at 82.4%. So that what we're talking about here is that not all kids can be placed together, but the majority of the kids can, which is really important for these kids. And again, this isn't about if there's a sibling group of six, very unlikely we're going to find a family who's going to take all six. We do at times. But it may be that we say, okay, maybe the aunt can take these three children, and maybe an uncle can take these three. So at least sibling connections are together, and then we do visits. So that is, I think that's really something that Oregon should be proud of as far as the work that's happening. Achieving permanency, some of the stuff we've talked about in other committees where we really are looking at saying there are children who have been in this foster care system for a long time under a long-term foster care or another planned permanent living arrangement, and there's some new strategies that we're learning around how do you start doing permanency roundtables where you get a collection of people around a table. And many ways, similar to a medical model where you've got different clinicians who have a different lens of what you're looking at. And you get people around a table and be able to talk about, here's Johnny's strengths, here's Johnny's needs, and here's Johnny's future. How do we do something different?
For yes. Somebody who may be new to this, explain what permanency is.
Okay. So thank you, Representative Tomei. So permanency really is trying to find where this child is going to continue growing up.
And not in foster care, but in an adoption situation.
So we look at permanency as being options of first goal is to return home if at all possible. If not, we're really looking at can we place the child adoptively into an adoptive family that they will raise the child. We are also looking at guardianships, and that's where relatives really sometimes step into it. And otherwise, we're looking at another planned permanent living arrangement, which is the least preferred. So we don't want that to happen, but in some situations that might occur. So we're trying to make sure that we don't have 40% or 30%, 20%. That's really the anomaly. There should be very few kids in those programs, but we've got to learn and change our practice because there are, the way the system is set up, there are sometimes reverse incentives to stay in foster care around tuition waivers, around financial support to the caregivers. We want to make sure that we actually are looking at that more holistically and saying the fact of the matter is the child really needs to have a permanent family, and that permanent family doesn't stop at 18. It doesn't stop at 21, and most of you that have children over 21, you understand what that means. I still want to be able to have my kids call me when they want to know how long do I cook an egg for, or what should I do about pancakes this morning, Dad. I want those kind of things to be asking. I want these kids to have the same opportunity to have somebody to call. So that's what we look at, permanency. What is permanency to people? So we're using technical assistance from Casey Family programs that come into Oregon to help us do some of that work, and really honing in on those older teenagers. So a lot of work has been done on the young kids, but the reality is these older teenagers, we really need to focus on them as well. I'm going to keep speeding through this, and you'll give me the high sign if I need to slow down or start talking.
Okay, we have a question here.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. How many foster children are adopted each year?
Do you have that?
I can bring my data book.
We're in the neighborhood of 700 to 800 kids, or children.
Follow up. I was wondering if when you place a child that you think is hoping to be adopted, I mean, they have a different category, do you first try and place them with an adoptive family, or do you place them with a foster family first and then move them to an adoptive family? Does that make sense? Because down in my district, we've had a case where somebody really wanted to adopt children, but first they had to go to a foster family, and it seems like it would make a lot more sense to put them with the adoptive family right off.
Most of the time, Chair Domi, most of the time our adoptive placements are their foster parents, and it's more likely or not that it's a selected second adoptive placement, the one that a move that you're talking about. Oftentimes that happens when there are no relatives, no kin resources, and the child's in foster care with a foster parent who's not going to adopt, and then we recruit and place the child in an adoptive home. But our goal is first placement, only placement,
right,
if at all possible, and that's why we look for kinship placements or kith placements, you know, of somebody that knows the child, and so then we don't have to look for that second,
right,
second or third move, okay, which contributes to placement stability.
Thank you.
So some of the real unique challenges that Marita alluded to earlier were things like we have a model where we actually specially certify families, as I talked about earlier, that we can actually go out and certify somebody today for children if they're a neighbor or family friend or relatives. The reality is we do the same body of work that we do for a non-relative. So we have that workload that's there, which is important because you're assessing the safety of a child. But that family we're out there assessing for one child, where 15 years ago, when I was doing that work, I'd be going out and assessing a family with the potential of taking in three or four children and maybe with us for the next 5 years. So it's a real different issue in terms of you still have that workload from a safety standpoint, but it's less efficient than it would have been where you were looking at someone who could take in a lot of children. But it's still the right thing to do. Relatives, again, identifying, locating, as I talked about earlier, can be challenging. Sometimes you have this set of grandparents that want this thing and this set of grandparents that want something different, and that's the reality. That's families. That's what our work is, and that's just the way it, that's the way it is, and the reality is relatives are critical to be with these children. At times we, not at times, we are always trying to keep children in the least restrictive environments as possible. That means family foster homes rather than residential programs. But at times we have, maybe we might have communities, we might have neighborhoods, we might have schools that really are not necessarily on the same page we are as far as keeping children in the same neighborhoods. So they may not have a school environment for a specific child or a program, or you may have neighborhoods who say, we don't want those children here in those communities. So those are realities that we're dealing with all the time as well. But the fact of the matter is children should be in the least restrictive environment as possible. And most oftentimes that means with the family, in their neighborhood, at the local school, doing the local activities as all the other kids. The other unique challenge that we have is really making sure that this system meets the needs of a 2-year-old while also meeting the needs of a 17-year-old. And so the models and services that we do for training with foster parents, to supporting foster parents, to identifying what kind of services or skills and knowledge that a family needs are really different for a 2-year-old versus a 17-year-old, but that's who we're serving and that's the model we've got. The next piece is then, I would just a brief update on, these are some of the legislative directions that we've had over the last couple of years from this body here. And it's things around improving the appropriate use of psychotropic medications. So we continue to work on that issue. We actually have a technical assistance grant right now with the Center for Healthcare Strategies. And I, along with Chris Barber, who is with the Oregon Health Authority, are co-directors of that project and continue to make some great success in that. We work on the CANS, which is a Child and Adolescent Needs and Strengths Inventory that we do for all children coming into foster care. We've really focused over the last several years on a lot of issues and supports around youth and young adults. And so we've had direction from this group, from this legislative body, to develop comprehensive transition plans for young people so that we know what's happening. And those comprehensive transition plans really are to address what is their plan for education, what is their plan for housing, what is their health plan, what is their employment plan, what is their plan for supportive and caring adults. So it's a holistic look at what these young people need. Fortunately, there was extending the opportunities for higher ed, so this is a reality now. Our foster youth are going to college. We have somewhere between 300 and 350 youth now accessing college systems here in Oregon as a result of the work that you've approved, which is great. And we also have been able to extend the health care coverage, so as a young person ages out of the system, maybe at 18, they have the option of selecting into the health care, which can continue until they're 21. And then they, through a partnership that was brought forward by the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, it's with the DMV. So we have a collaboration with DMV where our foster youth are able to take driver's education training, and then they will cover the cost of that work, which has been really a nice assistance.
Kevin,
yes.
We have a lot of people here to testify, and you have more to say.
Fair.
It's easy to get access to you than it is for some of these people who've come around the state. So we'll have you come back another time. We're going to have more hearings on this issue. So we'll have you come back another time. And any questions you want them to answer before they come back or to give some thought to, Representative Gumbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just early on in your presentation, you talked about cultural consistency. Could you just give me 30 seconds on expand on that a little bit?
Representative Tomei, Vice Chair Gumbert.
Gumbert, yes, sorry.
Thank you. What we want to do is we want to make sure children have the same experience out of foster care as they do in foster care in terms of their culture. And culture can be many things. And what we're saying is that we want to ensure that when a child comes into care that we're maintaining their important cultural connections. That might be with a tribe if the child's native. It might be if a child's from the Ukraine, maintaining their important cultural connections there. It might be just with their extended family member and being able to continue in some of the important cultural activities that go on just within a family. So that's what we mean.
I'm going to interrupt because I know we're pressed for time, but if I could have a quick follow-up.
Sure.
Among those different criteria, would you include religious background?
Yes.
Quick answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And maybe
you
could elaborate on that the next time you come back.
Okay.
Representative Gallegos.
That's exactly what I was going to ask for, was some elaboration. Particularly, I'm interested in where does the Indian Child Welfare Act fit in? How does it, where's the jurisdictional differences and that kind of thing? But we can do that next time.
And maybe you could let us know who we should invite to come back next time to address some of these issues and maybe some others that have been brought. And especially, I think, for the more rural areas, about foster care there and finding foster parents, et cetera.
Yep.
Any other quick questions you want them to talk more about next time?
Yes, if they could follow up with what your graduation or GED rates are and how important it is for them to complete their education since that's where their future lies. And I'd like to hear about that.
Right. Good. And I know we have some foster children here, and we'd like more. We want more foster children next time. We want more foster parents. And I know Catholic Family Services have brought some people on Reagan Gray also. But some of the people that maybe aren't involved in some of these other agencies, I think, would be great for us to hear. Representative Gallegos?
Representative
Winston. Wisnett, yes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. George, I passed a bill, I think, two sessions ago. I'm a big supporter of Family Fine. And I worked with Pat Carey. All of us have been here a while, have worked with with foster placement and child welfare. I passed a bill that said a judge who doesn't place a child with a relative who was asking for it should document his reasoning for doing that. I'd like to know if you followed up or if there's been any review of that issue. And also emancipation, if you could talk about how you introduce emancipation to foster children. Thank you.
Great. Anything else you'd like them to get more information about? Terrific. Thank you so much. That was very helpful. Is Mark McKechnie still here? Did he leave? Oh, here he is. Okay. I know, Mark, you've got another appointment. Thank you again so much, folks.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to speak today. My name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Director of Youth Rights and Justice. You may have known us previously as the Juvenile Rights Project. We changed our name a couple years ago. We've been in Portland representing children and parents in the juvenile court system since 1975, when we've represented over 50,000 clients. And I thought in the brief time that you have, I'd try to give you a little bit of an overview of where public defense fits into the foster care system, because I think a lot of times those issues often are heard in the Judiciary Committee and the fiscal issues are heard in the public safety side, but they're very relevant to the child dependency system.
It is, but and I know you have a lot to say, but we don't have a lot of time. Is there something you can tell us briefly and then come back again when we have another hearing?
Sure, I can do that. I did want to say that, when a family and when a child comes in contact with the child welfare system, it becomes a legal matter. There are many steps and procedures that occur in front of the court, from the initial filing of the petition, when the allegations by DHS are made that a parent has in some way endangered the welfare of a child. And it's at that point that attorneys are typically appointed to represent both children in foster care and the parents. And then our contact with those individuals and our representation of them continues all the way through the case until it's resolved, whether children return home or whether they're eventually adopted or end up in a guardianship, or unfortunately, as was mentioned, some stay in foster care for many years and eventually emancipate. The handout I gave you focuses on some of the research that's been done about why does it matter that children and parents have attorneys, and why does it matter that those attorneys have the tools that they need to do their jobs. And one of the issues we struggle with and have for many years is caseload sizes, having the resources to hire enough attorneys to give them reasonable caseloads to do the work that we need to do. And fortunately, there's been research done in Washington State that gives us much more specific information, basically confirms the things that we've known intuitively, that if we are going to be zealously representing our clients and seeking the outcomes that they want and they need, then we need to have the time to focus on each individual client's needs, counsel them, explain the situation they're in, help them understand what the court is deciding and what the court can order, and also help connect them to services. And so in Oregon, caseloads for attorneys often are 25-50%, even more over what the American Bar Association recommends are reasonable caseloads. But in Washington State, in about half of the counties, they've been able to reduce caseloads to within what the American Bar Association recommends. And the result of that, because we're talking about counties within the same state, so they have the same statutes, the same state child welfare agency. The variable was how many clients attorneys represent in one county versus another. So they found that there was a 39% increase in the rate of reunification when attorneys had manageable caseloads and had the investigation and the support that they needed to represent their clients effectively. And they also found that when children returned home, they were more likely to stay home. That's, an unfortunate thing we see in Oregon and other states, is that everybody works to move the child home, but often the underlying issues are not resolved, and once the child returns home, the services decrease, and the support that helped move the child home doesn't stay, and when that's withdrawn, you see children end up back in foster care. So having effective legal representation helps prevent that rebound and return to foster care. Even in the cases where children didn't return home, they found that those cases were resolved more often and more expediently, where adoptions were being achieved as much as a year sooner because of the quality of the legal representation, and also due to the fact that if you have more attorneys to do the work, you have fewer delays in the court process because the attorneys their calendars are full. You can't schedule hearings So there are setovers and delays that occur when you don't have enough attorneys in the system, and those problems were greatly reduced when the caseloads were reduced. So I have a summary of that in, yes, in the handout, and I also just gave you, for point of reference, the First Star program, which is a, out of one of the law schools in California, rated each state in terms of the statutory provisions they have for legal representation for children. And in terms of Oregon statutes, we rated fairly high. We got a B. It's funny, you can tell by the fact that the child next to Oregon is smiling, while the one that's in Washington looks more sullen. You can tell that we were doing a better job, that our statutes more consistently provide for representation for children, and that appointment occurs early in the case, and that children are a party to the case, equal to their parents and equal to the state.
We're going to move on.
Sure.
Yeah, but thank you for this.
We have a lot of good things going on. We are lacking some of the resources that we need to make it even better. Thank
right.
you.
Thank you so much. And maybe you can come back. All right. So with this, we'll hear from Children First for Oregon. Thank you for coming today. For the record, if you'd just state your name and go ahead.
Okay. All right. Good afternoon, members of the chair. My name is Patrick Kindred. I'm here with OFYC and
OFYC. And tell us what those words mean.
Oregon Foster.
Those letters.
Oregon Foster Youth Connection.
Great. Thank you.
And Oregon Foster Youth Connection is a statewide program. They work with former foster youth and current foster youth on advocacy for foster care kids. Do you want to introduce yourself?
No, just go ahead with what you have to say.
Okay. So I'm here to talk a little bit about SB 123, but more specifically, the reason why I'm so passionate about it and why I like to advocate for it. And I've been in foster care, I was in foster care from the age of 14 to 21. I just aged out this October. I go to the University of Oregon. I'm a junior. And again, the reason why I really like to advocate about this bill, even though I have just currently aged out, is because when I was going through foster care, I didn't ever get a sense that people cared about me. I didn't really get a sense that people really had my best interest. And it was like a dogfight to get where I'm at. And even now, even aging out, it's still kind of that dogfight. And that's why I feel like with this SB 123, it establishes...
You don't know what that bill is. So just tell us your experience, how long you've been in foster care, that what it was like for you, and what you'd like to see.
Okay. So my foster care experience, it was okay. Not to, I guess, demote what they were saying previous, but I was first placed in a family home, and I mean it was all smooth and roses because it was supposed to be your family. But eventually, that kind of fades away a little bit, and you start to see the clearer line, and the money starts to kind of take over place. And so that was kind of a struggle because you're already moving from one family into your next family, and you're hoping that they're going to show you the same love that family does. And when that kind of erodes away, and you have to start going to different houses, that's kind of like kind of shut off your emotions towards, like, I'm not going to reciprocate love back towards you if you're not going to give it to me kind of idea. But my experience with foster care, for the most part, I wouldn't say it was the worst, but it wasn't the greatest. And the reason why I would say it wasn't the greatest is because every time, I guess, as a foster care kid, I feel like I was placed with the label of a foster care kid. So not only was I fighting that foster care label, but I was trying to invent myself at the same time. And the only issue with that is I couldn't invent myself because I didn't have anyone that coincides with. I didn't have my foster parents to go and talk to them about, such as, how do you make pancakes? How do you make eggs? They were already focused on their kids. And my teachers, I mean, they're teachers. They already have a caseload of students. And so there wasn't really anyone to interact with. And that's kind of been my experience with foster care, is just that yearning for someone to care about you, understand where you came from, understanding history, something to kind of give you that kind of normalness in your life. And so that's kind of, I guess, my take.
How long were you in foster care?
17
years. You told us 17 years?
Yeah, 4 to 21.
14?
Age 4.
Okay, all right. And how many foster homes were you in?
I was in 4.
In 4 different foster homes. So to what do you owe your success now? Did you find what it was that you were seeking in a foster family?
No, I didn't find it in a foster family. I was actually fortunate enough when I was in first grade to get put in a program called Friends of the Children, started by a man named Duncan Campbell, and it gave me a mentor from the grade of first grade all the way through when I graduated high school. I saw him once a week, and my mentor, he was very instrumental in just demonstrating character and what is it to be a man of good character, and so I feel like that was very instrumental in me growing up. But unfortunately, not a lot of foster care kids get that kind of type of mentorship.
Thank you for sharing your story. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned about the pancakes and eggs that your foster families were kind of focused on their other children. When you went into a foster home and there were other children in the home, were you treated similarly to those other children, or was there a disparity in your experience as a foster child as opposed to the other children that might be permanently living in that home?
It always starts off, I feel like, as there's no disparity, it's always kind of like you feel like a guest at first, and so it seems like they're trying to make everything good, but it gets about after the first month, it starts hitting you. Just an example of me, I moved in with one of my friends after I left the other foster home and into another one. I thought everything was going to be good, but every day that I came home from school after like a practice or something, I already had to find my way home, but everyone would already be sitting at the dinner table eating, and there was no plate made for you, but they'll say, you know, hey, there's dinner in there, and it's kind of like little things like that, and I know it might not seem like a lot, but just to have an invite kind of to the table or have a plate made at the table or just little things to like feel a part of the family, it was like things like that where you didn't feel completely assimilated, but they were going to try to help you a little bit, but to the most where they didn't want to put you in their family, but that you could live and kind of be on your own, sort of.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'll just kind of go
with a surname, that. Please.
Royce Markley. I'm 19 years old, and I've been in foster care for 8 years. Just to speak on your question, Representative Gelser, that is probably one of the biggest problems that I had in my experience in foster care. It's not something that's really spoken about, but it's a huge problem, is that, you know, we don't have enough foster homes, and so you have to sometimes just go with what you get. And so foster homes that you go into that already have biological children in them, you don't feel like you're part of the family a lot of the time, but you take what you can get, sort of, I guess, so to speak. But for me, that's probably one of the biggest things that I went through. I had a relatively positive experience, and I've taken a lot of positive things from the foster care system. But a huge issue for me was that being in a home where you have other children and you know being treated second class, and you can't, you know, if you report to your caseworker that you're being treated as second class, it's not an issue that they're going to take you out of a home for, but I think that maybe that's something that should be considered, because as foster youth, you know, if you're treated second class, then you're probably going to grow up and act like a second class person, because that's just kind of how you've been treated. So just to go off what you said, yeah, oftentimes in homes, you feel second class to the biological children. So I'll tell you a little bit about my experience. So 8 years as a foster youth, like I said, I've been in approximately, I'm going to say, 7 foster homes in my 8 years. I was in foster care from age of 6 months to about 2 years, and then my later experience was as a teenager, and I've been in since then. Once again, 19 years old. I currently am still in foster care, and I go to Lynn Benton Community College in Albany. So basically, you said you guys don't know what SB 123 is, but I'll just briefly discuss what it is real quick. So, you know, SB 123 is a bill that basically has, you know, a bill of rights for foster youth inside of it, and it also has a hotline for us to call. So if it gets passed, the premise of the bill is that foster youth, upon entering the system, or if they're already current foster youth, when they turn the age of 7, will be handed a copy of their rights in language that they can understand, and someone will actually explain, like, their rights to them. And so this is really important to myself, current and former foster youth, and that's why we're here today, is because we didn't know our rights going through the system. I'm still going through the system, and up until, you know, recently, maybe within the last 3 or 4 months, I had no idea what my rights were as a foster youth. Unfortunately, we need extra rights as foster youth because we're dealing with a situation that's above and beyond what maybe like biological youth deal with. And so basically this is an opportunity for us to know our rights, better advocate for ourselves, and make our way through a difficult system. It's like lending a hand to us just so we can help ourselves. So that's basically what SB 123 is.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Whitson.
So what do you think is the weakest part of the system? Would you say that it's being moved from home to home to home, or what what would you say is the overarching in both of your opinions? How would you improve it?
That's a really hard question for me to answer. Like I said, I did have a fairly positive experience with foster care, but unfortunately, a positive experience in foster care is still not what I would say a positive, ideal experience for a kid is in general. But I guess for me, I couldn't even put like a first and second hardest thing in foster care. I would say definitely the moving around is very difficult. The lack of initiative from the resources that we have. I guess just now there was someone from, I don't know, a law. He was a lawyer, I guess, up here talking. It got me thinking that my lawyer, I literally see my lawyer when I go to court. I don't talk to her or see her unless I'm in court. And so for me, it just seems like the resources that we have, while they are available, it doesn't seem like they're being proactive, and it doesn't seem like they're taking the initiative to help us. Then again, you can contact them, but it just seems like some of the resources we do have are overworked, and that they don't actually have the time to really do what their job entails. It's the same with caseworkers. It's really hard for caseworkers to keep up with their caseloads, and so I think maybe more resources, if I was going to bundle it into one complaint, want like more resources.
I guess mine would be more FaceTime with really anyone. I mean, a kid going through that kind of emotional toll, rather it be with talking to a counselor. Because when I was little, I didn't think a counselor was good, and now sometimes I think things that I saw is like maybe a counselor would have been good to have all stages of growing up. But on top of that, just having someone to talk to. Like, we're assigned a caseworker, we're assigned a lawyer, but they're just like another face that we only see every 2 months, maybe once a year. And then we have our foster homes that we're already trying to get FaceTime there that we don't get. So to just some type of a space where foster kids go to someone and just have an outlet, talk to them, talk about their problems, talk about their everyday life. I don't know, maybe a forum. I don't even really know. Just FaceTime, let a kid really be a kid and understand from an adult how to grow up.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
I just want to thank you both. You present very well, and you're great advocates for other youth that are in the system. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? If not, thanks again. So we also have Catholic Community Services. You can just identify yourself and start talking. Somebody, identify yourself and start talking.
Sorry. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, my name is Aubrey Boyce, for the record. I came and testified, I think, about a month ago and told my story. I'm 18 years old. I live in one of our Catholic Community Services Forever Homes for Children. I'm graduating from high school this year, and I work at Catholic Community Services in the Communications Department. I'm here to answer any questions that any of you may have for my experience in care. I know you guys have heard it before, so.
We haven't. I think you were in another committee, but not in our committee.
Yeah, yes.
How did I miss that?
The Chief Justice.
What's that?
The Chief Justice, it was the Forever Home.
I was
the Forever Home.
Oh, yes, thank you. I'm sorry.
It wasn't a foster care bill, it was a Forever Home.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Aubrey.
That's okay. I was in foster care in California when my mom and grandma were sick for a couple years, on and off. And then my mom passed away when I was 7, as well as my grandma. And so then I moved up here to Oregon to live with my aunt and uncle. And I lived here for a little bit with them, and then things weren't very good. I got abused at that house. And my aunt passed away when I was 12. And so then from there I was put into foster care. I was in like a shelter home for a night because they couldn't find a place to put me. And then I had a family friend become a foster parent for me. And then that's when I found Catholic Community Services last minute, honestly. And it was probably one of the biggest blessings I've had in my life to find such a wonderful nonprofit organization to take me in. And I've lived there since I was 12, and here I am 18. And I was on a slow spiral downward, doing drugs, you know, all the mischief when I first got into that home. But then ever since then, I've, you know, done a lot better.
That's great. Thank you so much, Robbie. Thanks for coming back again.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Hi, I'm Sonia. I have been in foster care from age 6 to 18. I would like to say I've successfully transferred into adulthood through Catholic Community Services. I grew up in foster care with my brother and my sister. I was in 6 different homes by the time I reached 18. There were a lot of barriers, especially with kids or the parents having children in their homes that were biological. But at age 17, I was in a foster home through DHS, and I was living with my sister, and I wasn't happy. So I was also introduced to Catholic Community Services, and I got moved into the Forever Home. And it was the best thing that's ever happened. I lived there from age 17 to 18. I really love the foster parents. They have good morals. Like, there was six girls living there from age 12 to 17, and I got to experience so much. Like, the foster parents worked with me with getting my license and permit, and I grew in my faith, and I graduated high school, and they even bought me a yearbook, which was pretty great. Like, I've never experienced that before. But right now I'm living on my own, thanks to Catholic Community Services. I am living in one of the homes that they own. And I have a 7-month-old son who I take care of, and I actually work with Catholic Community Services now. So, thanks.
Great. Thank you, Sonia.
Chair Tobin, my name is Iba Jerkson. I'm a treatment foster parent with Catholic Community Services. I've been with them for 4.5 years. I have done foster care for about 12 years. One of the things that I work the hardest with the youth, I have boys who are 16 on to aging out of the program. One of the things that I work hardest with these children they're not children, they're youth, is teaching them skills, life skills, that are going to hold them over into adulthood so that they can become productive members of the community. It's hard for them because it's certainly different, but they do learn. Sometimes it takes as long as a couple of years for them to learn the skills, but if they can stick it out long enough, they end up having the skills that they need to become productive members of our community. Some of them go on to school. Some of them find jobs. Some of them don't succeed, and we just take them back and go again with them.
So do you stay in contact with some of the young people who have been with you?
I do. It's really very nice to suddenly have a phone call or a knock at the door, and they say, "Hi, do you remember me?" And then they go on to tell me what they've done with their life, what jobs they're working, if they have children, if they have families, you know, what they're doing. And it's really nice to hear that.
Of course. That's great. Any questions for any of these wonderful women? Thank you so much for coming. Oh, we have one new person here.
Hi, thank you. My name is Jessica Thomas, and I'm one of the mental health therapists that works with exclusively with 3 of the homes. And so I work with the children individually and with the entire family regularly. I give them a lot of therapeutic support and connect them with the different resources in the community. One thing that we try to do is get them involved within the community with, you know, youth activities, volunteer opportunities, and probably what I've seen is that they feel a sense of belonging, support, consistency, permanency, and it's been a great, I think, a great opportunity for the kids I've seen, their progression. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
So you've been with Catholic Community Services, and how long have you been with them?
Just about a year and a half.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions? The therapist. It certainly seems that these two young men were saying they would have liked to have had a person throughout their lives that they could just talk to.
That.
Yes, and that is so important. So it's wonderful that these young people do have that available to them. That's terrific.
Yeah, I think it's one of the unique things about the community homes is that each home has a family therapist and
who works
with them. Yeah, each home. So I work with three of the homes, and so I'm always there. The foster parents can call me when they need support, and I see them a few times a week sometimes. So, yeah, excellent support.
And are you available to the foster parents also?
Yes, yes. I work with the foster parents. I work with the foster parents, and then I work individually with the kids, and then I also have family sessions.
You have what sessions?
Family sessions.
Family sessions, so the whole group of
yes.
the family
mm-hmm.
that would be meeting. That's great. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering about the difference in the forever homes versus, you know, the rapid transition that some of you went through in the regular placement system. Is it because of the level of services that you stay longer, or is there just a real commitment on the part of the forever home that we're not going to kick kids out? Like, what is it that you stay there through when you age out? What is it, just this, we're not kicking anyone out under any circumstances? I'm just trying to understand the difference here.
Representative Kenny Geyer, I think that at Catholic Community Services, there's a real sense of caring around each of the children. And like you were saying, yes, they're not going to kick us out. I've had foster sisters that have lived with me that have gotten into trouble, mischief, what have you, and they haven't kicked them out. Mm-hmm. I'm allowed to stay in this home until I'm 21 years of age if I'm working or going to school and doing something positive with my life. And I feel like there's a difference between Catholic Community Services Forever Homes and just a normal foster home, because we have people like Jessica or even Mr. Seymour, the executive director. I feel comfortable enough to go into his office and make an appointment and talk to him if I have any type of issues going on. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm graduating this year, and I feel very supported mm-hmm. by moving out, because I'm planning to move out in June. I feel very supported by not only my caseworker and my attorney, but just all the different supports and family therapists. Even if they don't work directly with my home, I know I can go to any of them at any time mm-hmm. for help.
And you're moving out, so then what are your plans for the immediate future?
Chair Tomai, my plan is to hopefully move out in June. I'm saving up for a car right now, and then I plan to start at Chemeketa for fall term, and I'm going to have my RN license and do preterm nursing when I go into fall term, and then I want to transfer after 2 years at Chemeketa. I want to transfer to either Western Oregon University or University of Oregon. I'd like to also minor in youth and family studies.
And how will you finance this?
I will finance this by financial aid, and I also hear that there is a bill that whatever my financial aid and scholarships and grants can't cover, the state of Oregon will cover the rest.
And will the Catholic Community Services follow you through this if in your forever home?
Yes. I am almost 1,000% positive that I could call them up at any time, and they will help me out with anything I need. I have my supervisor at work actually help me with my FAFSA to fill out my financial aid forms.
So you could stay there at the home, right?
Yes,
so I could. Why are you choosing not to stay there?
At this point in my life, I feel like I have matured and grown enough that I would like other children to be able to have the opportunity to come into the home and live there if I feel like I'm ready to move out on my own. I know that if I do crash and burn, I can go back, but I feel like at this point in time, I have them to support me as a backbone if I'm out on my own.
Great. Any further questions? Thank you so much.
Chair. Yes.
Just briefly, I noticed the head nods about the yearbook, kind of the purchase in the yearbook. What are some of the other things like that, I mean, usually when we have hearings, we talk about the process in the homes, but these things that are part of a typical youth life, what are some of those things that maybe we should be thinking about that are part of a positive youth experience that are missing right now, like yearbooks?
Just like the family dynamic, is that what you mean? In the home that I was in, we got to do things just that mock a real family, I guess. Like, we got to go to the zoo, I remember, during the summer quite a bit. And I was sports in high school, so it felt really good when my family was supporting me at my games. So stuff like that.
Chair Tomlin, I think that some of the things that they get through that is like going to the prom and going to the snowball dance and those kinds of things that aren't always available for them. The community has really come together and getting prom dresses and clothing for them to go to those. And those are all things that I think get missed a lot of times in foster care.
Right. So too. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you all so much for coming, and good luck to all of you. Now we will be hearing from Youth Villages. Hi, Lynn. I think I see more young people who have decided apparently not to speak. We would love to hear from them. If you'd like to come up, just very informally tell us who you are and where you are in the system. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, I'm Lynn Saxon. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Villages Oregon, and I have with me today Daisy Cholula on my left, who is a clinical supervisor with our organization, and Andrew Grover, who is our Assistant Director of Oregon Operations. And we have a brief PowerPoint to show you about our work. I want to just give you a few things before we start about our organization. First of all, we're the organization formerly known as Christie Care or Christie School, quite possibly Oregon's oldest charity, founded in 1859. 2 years ago, seeking solutions to all the things we've just spent the last hour and a half talking about, we went out and looked for the best proved, measurable, successful outcomes for children and families in Oregon. And that search led us to Youth Villages and led us to a collaboration that was funded initially by some of the largest foundations in Oregon and led ultimately to our merger. We're currently serving kids in all 36 counties in Oregon in our residential programs, and we're serving six counties with our intensive in-home services, and we expect to serve the entire state with intensive in-home services, including rural areas, which is a real focus for our organization as well. Our ability, as we've said in other hearings during this session, is to grow at a rate of 500 youth per year in our intensive in-home intervention, which is an alternative to foster care. We certainly work with foster families. But the focus for our organization always has been permanency and success for children and families, as all of us measure success for children and families, which is completing their educational goals and becoming active members of the community. So with that, I'm going to stop and let Andrew go through a quick PowerPoint, and then Daisy will share her experiences as both a clinical supervisor and a former foster youth herself.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, before they move off the opening slide, I just wanted to say how impressed I am with the logo that they've selected. For
They don't even. Do you understand his joke? Maybe not everybody understands, Representative. Could you explain that?
Oh, I'm in my other life, I'm a professional kite flyer.
I know, and we'd like to talk to you about that.
But we digress. Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tomei.
I'm Andrew Grover from Youth Villages. I'm going to go through this part pretty quickly, so please stop me if I go too fast. We thought we'd start with some basic statistics. In Oregon in 2011, almost 13,000 children spend at least one night in foster care. That means that on any given day, 10 out of every 1,000 kids in our state were in foster care. That's an average of 8,800 on any given day. Nationally, it's about half that. About 5 of every 1,000 youth are in foster care in as a national average. So obviously, we're twice the national average. We don't know what happens in aggregate to these young people after they leave the system. And sadly, we find ourselves slipping on a number of indicators of health for young people in our communities. This is one example where we ranked 33rd in a data book put together by the Casey Family Programs. That was a slide from 18th in 2011. We wanted to talk a little bit today about the INTERCEPT program, which, as Lynn talked about briefly, is an intensive in-home support program designed to divert youth from being put into the foster care and reunify those who are removed. The program's relentlessly focused on permanent solutions, the kind of permanency that kids need to have to feel welcome at the dinner table and to be able to look at their future in a different way. We look at every system that impacts the family, doing ongoing safety planning, and we do this in a very intensive way. Our counselors are with families at least 3 times a week.
Now, this is the biological family you're speaking of, or the foster family?
This is the what we would consider a permanent family. It can be a biological family. It may be a relative. It may be another person who is working toward adoption. But we are focused on whoever is going to be taking care of this young person, generally without being paid.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And are these inclusive? For instance, I know we have many children with significant behavioral needs related to autism that are leaving their family homes. Are those children on your caseloads as well?
Yes. And in fact, one of the things that we're most excited about is we serve children currently in all of the major funding streams for children in the INTERCEPT program. So autistic, special needs, the gamut.
So just a few important points about the program. We're on call 24 hours a day, and that means we do go to people's homes. We end up in the ER. We're sometimes at the Juvenile Justice Center, wherever we need to be. We coordinate with all the different systems, including schools. But one of the most compelling things about it from us, from an operational standpoint, is the research that we do. And I'll touch on this in just a minute, but we follow these youth for 2 years after their experience with us in the program, and to see how are they doing, and we'll talk about that in a moment. We provide these services in quite a number of states, and so we have an enormous database of how are kids doing after they are in programs like ours. Because in all of these states, for over 20 years, we've been following these kids for up to 2 years after their experience. In Oregon, you can see that we're currently providing this service there's only 4 counties here. We do pick up some kids in other counties on a single kind of case agreement is what we call them. But we're working with coordinated care organizations. We're working with the Department of Human Services and with juvenile justice in Multnomah County right now. So in terms of outcomes, as of December of 2012, we had served 124 kids in Oregon. And these are their demographic profiles, just very quickly.
This is total? All the years you've been here, is this for 1 year?
This is a total. We started providing INTERCEPT in March of 2011. And this goes through December of 2012. We've been growing all that time, and we expect to serve a great many more, but this is where we are now. I would consider this preliminary data. These are the age groups. You can see we serve youth of all ages. 20% of the kids are 8 or under. You can see that the majority of the kids are of teenage years. At the time that youth leave our services, we want to know where they're going. And you can see here that the vast majority of them, well, let me back up quickly. On these next couple slides, the red bar is youth in Oregon, and the blue bar is from our national data set. So we're trying to get a comparison of, okay, how are we on track with what we're seeing in the data nationally. In Oregon, you can see there are 57 youth represented here, but the national data is almost 11,000. So at the time of discharge, nationally, these are youth villages, intercept services in other states, 88% of the youth were at home. And again, when we say home here, we mean a biological home, a relative. Some of these youth were living independently, or an adoptive home. These are not foster homes. Okay, and the next slide here talks about follow-up. So these are the three key indicators that we look at. We ask a whole lot of questions. We call young people and their families at three intervals: 6 months after they left, 1 year after they left, and 2 years after they left. Right now we have only a small sample of kids who have been gone 6 months in Oregon, and that's the red bar there. And these are, we ask them a great many questions, but these are the three key questions we ask. Are you still living at home? Are you staying out of trouble with the law? And are you going to school? Or have you graduated? And we're happy to report that we're tracking the same as we've seen in the national data. The blue bar is, again, the national data, and that represents over 5,000 kids who had discharged and been followed up. And we shoot for a minimum of 80% success rates in these key indicators. These are the kinds of things that we don't know collectively for the system at large, but we're happy to report that we are tracking this at Youth Villages, and we take it very seriously.
Let me just add one quick thing just for clarification. We did go through a merger, probably the largest nonprofit merger in Oregon, 2 years ago. And so part of what I want to be clear is that it isn't that Oregon is coming up short in any of these categories. There's a development curve of kind of getting the infrastructure in place, the training in place. So we expect to meet or exceed all the other states here real quickly. But our organizational goal is always above 80% success.
Yeah, and again, these are not kids who, you know, weren't going into foster care or residential treatment or some other type of service anyway. These are all kids that odds are they would have been in the foster care system for a very long time, probably aged out, maybe gone through a few residential placements. And so we're really pleased to see that we're making this kind of an impact. This last slide talks about cost. And this is based on an analysis that we're actually working with DHS on right now to vet some of the assumptions in here, because they're every bit as interested in this stuff as we are. And the basic idea here is that we went through and we said, okay, well, how much does it cost to serve 100 youth in the foster system? And then compare that to what it costs to serve 100 youth with Intercept. And this is the CANS is an assessment of needs and strengths is what it is. And every child that goes into foster care gets a CANS assessment after something like 30 days. And when they get a CANS assessment, they're assigned a level of need. And based on that is the reimbursement that the foster parent would get because of the different supervisory kinds of needs that these kids present with. Some kids get a foster CANS assessment of zero, and they're not reflected on here. These are the kids who do get different levels of supervisory kind of supports.
Wait, I'm not familiar with that CANS. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure. It's an assessment
of your assessment?
No. This was developed by Dr. Lyons, and he's in Chicago, I believe. And it basically goes through all the different domains in life, and it says, you know, what strengths does this child or family have in this area? What needs does this child or family have in this area? And it kind of says, okay, well, if you have a level 3 need, there's some urgent something that needs to be addressed there. If you have a 0, you're just fine. And you kind of go through like that. There's probably, I forget how many, but there's probably 40 or 50 different questions that are asked on there and scaled that way. And if the aggregate is a CANS level 3, then the foster parent gets additional money to help support that child because they have more needs. Does that make sense?
No. Am I just missing something? No. So who provides that extra funding?
If child DHS.
So DHS would spend this much per 100 youth, over $4 million, you're saying,
yes.
If the child shows this level of need. Is that right?
That's right.
Thank you.
That's right.
Okay. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. And for the kids in Intercept, are they, most of them, level 2 and level 3? Are they across the board?
Yes, we see mostly level 3 kids. Okay. Certainly, many of them probably wouldn't even make it in foster care. They'd be in residential kinds of placements.
So your comparison is really to the $4.3 million.
Yes, that's a fair statement.
That you can provide service to the same level of need, but at a cheaper cost.
That's our position on this. Yes, and there's also a level on here that's not even reflected here. These are kids who are in residential placement, and we work very hard to get them out of residential. They'd cost even more. They wouldn't fit on the chart.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just as Chair Tomei as an amplification of that, Intercept was designed 20 years ago, and the model was created as an alternative to residential care. So it brings that level of rigor and support that one would expect to see, for example, in what we call in Oregon psychiatric residential treatment services, which cost probably around $480 a day and are reimbursed around $380 to $420 a day. So we didn't talk about that very much today because of our focus on foster care, but the intervention was designed to be successful at that level of acuity.
Great. Thank you.
Those are our names.
Okay. Thanks. Any questions? Oh, go ahead.
Chair Tomei, I am Daisy Cholula, Clinical Supervisor with the Oregon Intercept Program. I have firsthand experience with being a foster child in Oregon. I aged out when I was 18. I was in foster care since I was 15, and then prior to that, I was in the California foster care system when I was 5 for about a year. And now working as a mental health professional in the field and working with Intercept, it's been a really great experience to see what interventions and what things we're doing in the home to prevent children from being removed or supporting them to return home. One of the biggest success stories that we've had has been a foster child. They were in a foster home for about 6 months. And in that 6-month period, they were about to be removed from that foster home and going to another one. And so Intercept Services came in to stabilize the child in that foster home to wait for the parent to be able to care for this child. So we were successful in being able to meet the needs, mental health needs of this child, and be able to transition them successfully to their biological mother. So that was one of the ways that we were able to intervene, is stabilization, safety planning, supporting the foster family, and encouraging them to continue to support the youth and meeting the mental health needs of that child as well.
And you stayed involved after the child returned to
them? When they returned home, it was still an open case with DHS, and they closed shortly after we had discharged as well.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sounds like a fascinating program. Jessica, I think you said somebody else would like to speak to us. And if there are other young people, I think most of them have left by now, haven't they?
They didn't want to hear me. Madam Chair and members, my name is Roy Tinsley, and I am a treatment foster parent for Catholic Community Services. And I just wanted to say that We do this because we care about what happens to our children. My wife and I have raised our own children, and we have grandkids. But these kids don't have that permanency that our children had. So we try to, in our home, in all of our homes with Catholic Community Services, is to treat them as our own, as you would yours. That's the way you treat them. So that when they come to visit, our own children come to visit, there's no separation. So they don't know that they're different, and which they aren't, but they're not treated any different. And I just wanted to let everybody know that that's kind of what Catholic Community Services does.
And Roy, how long have you been a foster parent?
I was with DHS. My wife and I were with DHS for 7 years. We did medically fragile children. And then we've been with Catholic Community Services for 2 years.
Great. And how many children, how many foster children have you had?
Well, so with Catholic Community Services, we've had the two boys we have right now, which are 13 and 16. We had another boy there with us. He was 16. And we've had several others that have just passed through because they were aging out and they went to independent living services that we have. So it's been a very rewarding experience.
Have you been able to stay in contact with the children who've left your home?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, we see them all the time. When I usually end up taking the 16-year-old to school and see the other ones there that are with their parents. They live with their parents, or they've moved to a different community home because it was a different situation. They fit better there. But it is a forever home. They don't like to say that, but that's what it is. They can, when they leave, they can come back. If they're going to school, they can come back and visit. Say hi, hey, how you doing? You know, spend the night. So it's not like, it's like your own kids coming back from vacation.
That's great. Any questions? Thank you. Thank you for being a foster parent. It's not an easy job. Thank you very much.
Not easy, but it's very rewarding.
Good. I'm glad.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak? We are open and we have some time to listen. Jessica, are you coming up to speak?
No.
She said no.
Kurt.
Especially if there are any foster children here or former foster children. Anyone else? You have time to speak. All right. Thank you all very much. Thank you for all the work you do. I think our foster kids have all left, but we certainly wish them well. With that, we have a visit to the state hospital on Wednesday, and we'll talk by email to figure out where we meet and how we can carpool.
Madam Chair, do we have a sense of what time it'll be finished?
Well, I would like to have you back here at 5.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And with this, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
Yeah,
thank you very much.